Blog Talk Radio.
The following program is brought to you by Columbia Southern University. Visit columbiasouthern.edu.
Good evening, this is Billy D. Hayes, your host for Stop, Drop, and Roll with the Punches. We have a special edition show tonight coming to you live from Orange Beach, Alabama. We have a live show that is going to be more than live. It's going to be lively. We have been researching a little topic that's been a hot topic in the fire service over the last couple of years, quite honestly, and certainly over the last couple weeks. It's really got hot, especially on my Facebook page, and I tend to stir it up a little bit. So I had a post that I put out, and certainly all the individuals who commented on it were stirred up in one way or another. So one of them suggested, you know, well, this would be a great radio show, so let's do that. So I worked with our producer, John Mitchell, and thank you, John, for pulling this together kind of last minute and less than a week's notice of putting a show on. But I think it's one that we need to talk about. Certainly, I know there's going to be a lot of people listening tonight, because we've been blasting out over Facebook and Twitter, and a lot of people have been sharing as I've been watching the social media. So I'm sure we'll have some folks listening in, and hopefully we'll have some call-in. Right now I've got three of my friends on that are going to be on the show with me. I've got Anthony Cred, my buddy Tony out of New Jersey. Tony's a longtime member of the fire service, retired member, but heavily involved with the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, especially on Memorial Weekend up in Emmitsburg. I've got another friend of mine, Jason Harmson, who is a Metro Atlanta lieutenant, and he is called in because he's got a different perspective, and that's what I like about these guys is they all have something different. And then another friend of mine who is also an advocate with the Everyone Goes Home program but been a longtime member of the fire service, John Marsh, who's on the call with us tonight. And then we'll have a couple other folks calling in as they do. I know John will let me know when they arrive on the air, and we'll talk about it. We've got a friend of mine from D.C. that I worked with when I had my short stint up in Washington, D.C. fire, and then another individual who is a prevention advocate but was a public information officer and educator at the Georgia Fire Academy who will be calling in as hopefully he can make it back from North Dakota in time. So let me give you a little background of why we're having this show tonight. So in the last couple weeks, we've had 7 children die in a fire in New York City that we know took its toll not only on the community, but obviously the family, but also on the fire service itself and FDNY. In fact, the chief of FDNY who was at the press conference was broken down into tears and said this is certainly one of the worst ones he's ever been a part of, and this is an individual that rose through the ranks as a Jake firefighter all the way up to the lead the department. So he's been there, done that, and definitely got many, many, many T-shirts to prove it. Then yesterday, as you probably saw through social media on April 1st, which was certainly no April Fool's Day for many people, Cincinnati buried one of their own, FAO Daryl Gordon, who was lost in the line of duty after falling down an elevator shaft on a structure fire, high-rise structure fire, in Cincinnati, and I know that affected John, and certainly I have many friends up in the Ohio area that were touched by that event. And then we also had a captain with the Fresno Fire Department who, you've seen the video, took one step and into the roof, down he goes, engulfed in flames, suffered 65% burns over his body, second, third degree, and will be in the hospital for quite a while. And certainly it touches me more than just that because Captain Dern is also a graduate from Columbia Southern University, 2009 graduate. So it certainly reached out and touched us here at CSU. And then more importantly, kind of what stirred this whole thing up and got the discussion about what's the balance is, as some of you know, I write for FireRescue1.com. And on a recent Facebook post a couple weeks ago, they put on a photo. It was a staffer that did it. It was unintentional, and I kind of knew that from the beginning, that had the face of Jim Carrey, and it said, the look I have when we're dispatched to a structure fire. And I understand the funniness and the comedy of that, but it was more of the comments that followed with that post that I just found that was disturbing, simply because I write for them, and when you put that kind of material out there, certainly it's gonna draw attention. I certainly know that from the two articles I wrote on, quote, fire porn, that every magazine cover that we see in our industry, the publications, has got some type of death and or destruction on it, and we really don't focus on what our job is, which truly is preventing fires. So we have a lot of things that's occurred in the last 2 weeks, which brings to question, where are we in the fire service and what's going on? What are we teaching our people? How are things evolving? So I want to read a post, and I'll end it with my little rant here with this, because this is something that we're facing in the fire service. So this was a quote on the Fire Rescue One post, again, the Jim Carrey post, and here's what we have out there. It says, to all the whiners and those who have been butthurt by this post, what in the world is wrong with you people? Did you join just to sit around and watch TV? Did you just join for the check and the insurance? I think I speak for the majority when I say I joined to fight freaking fires. I'm career 10 years, and that's what I still enjoy doing. I enjoy working the jaws at car wrecks. I enjoy turning the corner at 2 a.m. in the morning and seeing flames through the roof. Does fishermen not want to catch fish? Do cops not want to get in police chases and catch bad guys? Does the Marines not want to go to war and fight? If you want to just do prevention, then put on your Sparky the Fire Dog suit and do your thing and leave firefighting to firefighters that enjoy the battle. We aren't called fire preventers. We're called firefighters. We fight fires. Good Lord, you ninnies need to get a grip on these emotions. So that was a post by an individual on the Jim Carrey blog on Fire Rescue One, and I said, you know, I kind of had enough, and that's where I launched into it. So with that being said, the topic of tonight's show is are we out of balance? And there's a fine, very thin line about being mentally prepared, battle prepared, when that call does come in, and then also those who sit around hoping and wishing that call comes in. And especially in social media these days, we're not the only ones who read social media. If we think we are, we're fooling ourselves, because the public sees this, our elected officials see this, and people ask, and I've had somebody ask, do you guys really sit around and hope that somebody's house burns down? So we've got to fight a public relations issue, especially in tough economy times and things that we all face in the fire service with budget cuts, and how do we move forward? So we're going to open the discussion up, and I'm going to start asking some questions, and I'll bring folks in as we go. So I want to begin with Tony up in New Jersey. Tony, certainly I know you guys up in the Northeast, older structures and fought a lot of fires up there, especially in your retired area, Burlington Township, but I know you've been in other areas of the country. So let's talk about that thin line. How should we be mentally prepared in the fire service but not be hopeful for disaster?
Well, Billy, you know, that's an excellent question. And actually, while teaching a crew resource management conference yesterday to a lot of dedicated firefighters in Michigan, I addressed this also. It starts when we bring in our new recruits. We tell them, hey, whether it's volunteer, career, come on, join our service, you know. We're going to fight fires. We're going to rescue people. We're going to cut cars open. And when I started, you know, that sounded pretty cool. But it took me about 6 months to realize, wow, this is like the fourth night in a row I got up for an alarm system, or, you know, I got up for a dumpster fire, and where are all these working fires? And don't get me wrong, it's not that we didn't see work, but it wasn't to the level. So I bring that up because when we indoctrinate, and yes, indoctrinate our new recruits, whether they're volunteer or career, we need to tell them exactly what to expect. Hey, we're a fire department, but and I say this generally, it's different in different areas of the country and different systems, but we're a fire department, and you know what? Occasionally we fight fire. And I can tell you, Burlington Township, where I'm retired out full-time, but I still volunteer. I'm still an active medic, still active on a technical rescue team. So as you can see, I also want to be there when somebody has an unfortunate day, but I surely don't wish it on them. We need to educate the people early on about what you're going to do. Hey, you know what? You're going to join the fire department. We're going to train you to be combat ready. We're going to train you to be mentally ready, but we're not going to be we're not going to see a lot of fire. When we do see fire, you need to be ready. You need to do your job professionally, and you don't do what I saw at a fire in my former fire department in New Jersey a while back. And a guy comes out in front of family and does a high five with other firefighters. I understand your excitement. I understand you feel that you did a great job. But we really got to get a better perspective on who we are and what we are in the community. I talked to from respondersafety.com, and he says, you know, firefighters don't get the big picture. We need to work a little harder in that whole indoctrination, that early indoctrination of cadets is on the big picture. And I'm going to end it with this. We don't start with how to advance a hose line down a hallway. We don't start on how to open up a roof or how to wear your SCBA. That's not the problem. It's people skills. It's interpersonal skills. It's behavioral skills that are a problem. So before you teach them any of those skills, and I talked with a Marine colonel about this yesterday, we need to teach them about people skills, interpersonal skills. We got to teach them about behavioral and attitude that we expect from them. And I use a little acronym. It's called HEART. It's honor, it's ethics, it's accountable, responsible, and being trustworthy. So maybe if you have a little heart when you start the job, you might have a little bit better perspective as you go through your career.
Tony, it's funny you mentioned the high five incident, because that was a catalyst moment for me in my career. And I can remember, I think it was 1992, and our, at 6 a.m. on a Christmas morning. I mean, I had to work the Christmas Eve because I was a junior guy. And Christmas morning at 6 a.m., we catch a working fire. And that was like the gift of Christmas to me, because I was in that mindset. I was the one hoping and watching. And after we had just tore the house apart and doing a there was no reason to do a search and rescue because the family was outside. They told us they had all got out, but we still going through. Things were getting broke. Me and my partner actually fell through the ceiling on into the one of the kid's bedroom. And, you know, it was just, we were laughing, hilarious. I mean, it was the wrong frame of mind. And we come out walking down the driveway, and it was like it happened yesterday. And Ken Scanlon was my partner, and he and I high-fived one another going to the truck. It's like, man, did we put a good stop on that? We got in the attic, knocked it down. Man, high five. Christmas Day. Yeah, baby. And there stands this family to my left looking at us, crying, and I'm thinking, what in the world am I doing here? It's like God hit me in the back of the head, like, you idiot. This is what we're dealing with. This family, this is their Christmas gift. And my Christmas gift was to have a working fire, and their Christmas gift was for their house to be destroyed, their presents to be destroyed, the emotional and mental trauma that they went through. I changed after that, and it's funny you said the high five, because that was the moment for me that really did something different for me, and I've never gone back to that mindset since. So I want to go to Jason, because in this the conversation we had in the post of us having this dialogue, Jason brought up some good points, and I don't want anybody to misinterpret what I'm saying. You have to be ready, and I think Jason said it best. We know it's going to happen. Things are going to happen. And when it does, I want to be the one there, because I want to be able to mitigate that. So this is the thin line, the people who say, yeah, I want to be the one on the wall. I want to be the one protecting. But it's only a couple inches away from saying, but gosh, I sure hope it happens on my shift, because I'm ready to go. I'm ready to do that. So, Jason, I'm going to ask you kind of the same question. What is the thin line? How do we prepare ourselves?
First, thanks for having me on here, Billy. I really appreciate it. You obviously stirred up some stuff with that post. That's great that we're having this debate. You're right. It's such a thin line. I've been in the fire service just about 20 years. You know me. We worked in very close vicinity. It's tough to say. You know, being a lieutenant, I feel like I want those pit bulls on my crew. I want the guys who are on that razor's edge, you know, the ones that want to test themselves. You know, the type of people we have in the fire service generally are type A personalities. They're doers. They're competitive by nature. I mean, we all know that. There's got to be some levity thrown in there. I couldn't agree more with the other comments that were said. It's almost like I'm playing two sides of the same coin here. It's, you have to put some levity in. Now, the big question mark is, where is it and how do you do it? How do you settle these guys down that want to do this so bad, but at the same time, when you get it, you know, they're ready to roll. My personal take on it is I want them sitting on the edge. I want them ready to rock at any given moment. But at the same time, I want them to see the human element. I want them to realize that no matter what we're going to, it's somebody's worst day of their life, possibly. And that's a very, very tough one to deal with, because you're right. The guys we get in now, and the guys and girls, the ladies and women, you know, men that get into the fire service, it is a lot of times that adrenaline that, oh, we're going to do this cool stuff here and there. And it's years down the road before they realize, okay, that's not what it's all about. You know, there's other things involved here. We've got to figure out a way to bring that levity up to the forefront when they begin their careers. So I'm riding the fence on this subject, really. I'd like to hear what some more comments are, but, you know, great topic.
Yeah, and we certainly don't, and I am not an advocate for a softer fire service. That's not what this is at, because I think our fire service has progressed in the 20-plus years I've been in it. Jason, I know you've seen it, so is John Marsh and Anthony. But we've got to watch what we do, because I think part of the issue, and Tony hit on this when he spoke just a moment ago, is when we bring people on in the service and we bring them on the job, we give them a false sense of a job description, and we let them believe that they're going to fight fire every day. We let them believe they're going to make heroic grabs, and we want them to be prepared for that. Don't get me wrong. We want them prepared for that, but we also do not prepare them that's not going to happen every day, and especially over the last several years, and Jason, you hit on this in the post, is the fires have gone down. We have reduced fire through prevention, through awareness, through sprinkler systems and things of that nature. However, when we wish for that event to come in and we sit around, we have to look at the magnitude of when it does. And John Marsh, I'm going to bring you into this, because I know the loss of FAO Daryl Gordon in Cincinnati, and you being from the Ohio area, that certainly had an impact on you. How do we mentally prepare ourselves when we sit there and say, man, I can't wait for that call to come in, and that next call, we're going back and we're seeing that empty pair of shoes still on the bay floor because we lost one of our brothers or sisters that didn't ride back on the truck with us?
Well, naturally, that will be a horrible but good lesson for the younger guys that are and ladies that are coming on into the service, the fire service. Big objection is it goes back to when you come on to the fire service, you're gung-ho, you're ready to learn firefighting, and you want the red lights and the sirens and the speeding down the road and, you know, the loud mufflers and all that. That's what lures these kids nowadays. And pretty much so, it's what lured you, myself, and Jason and Tony and everybody on the line here. That's what we looked at in the beginning of going into the fire service. We didn't look at the original intent of the fire service, which goes back, of course, to the Roman times, but we can take it up to Ben Franklin and the prevention deal. That was the whole purpose of the fire service. That was his intent, was to prevent the fire before it ever got going. And that's where I think we lose. As Jason said, we've lost any handle on making fire prevention as exciting as firefighting, technical firefighting. We have to find ways, other than Sparky the dog, the fire dog, other than having just one person on your department who handles the Fire Prevention Bureau, we have to find ways of bringing in new construction type to where you can talk to people on the street about the things that are killing our firefighters. And our firefighters, of course, have to understand what's killing them before we can talk about it. Remember, I can remember one time in Cincinnati, actually, and this goes back to 1967 or so, and I can remember doing a fire prevention program that year. I was a firefighter, and I was elected to do the class that day to all the little kids. They were actually like sixth graders or so. And I went on with my big spiel, and I said, you know, kids, we're the only people in the world who are trying to work our ways out of a job. We don't want to fight fire. We want fire to end. We want you to go out and prevent fire. We want you to go home and teach your parents to be fire safe and so forth. And I really felt good about that speech, and we got onto the tailboard of the truck. We still rode the tailboard then. And I'll never forget Bruce Smith, who's still chief of Coal Ring Fire up in the Cincinnati area. He was on the tailboard that day with me. And he and another guy, and they started laughing at me as we were pulling out of the schoolyard there. We were on our way to another school. I said, what are you guys laughing at? And they said, well, who are you trying to BS? There's no way in the world that you want to be out of business. There's no way in the world that you want to quit fighting fires. And I thought about it, and he was right at the time. But as the years rolled by, you begin to see how ludicrous it is to sit around and wish for a fire in the firehouse. What an oxymoron that is to say, I wish I could go out and fight a fire tonight. You know, an insurance company would roll over if they heard a firefighter sitting around saying things like that.
Well, and I think the difference, though, John, is that the insurance companies would rather it burn down. And certainly, you know, for the people we serve, we want to get their possessions because that is a job that we've been sworn to, is to protect lives and property. But we lose a lot of firefighters in abandoned houses or vacant properties, even when we have people stand. And I was the story I told. I was a victim of that. The people are out. Hey, we're all out. We're here. There's the fire. Go get it. And we still do primary, secondary searches looking for victims. And sometimes we get lost and we lose brothers and sisters because we're so caught up in our patterns. And back to what we said, I think we don't have enough fires, which is a good thing, but it's almost counterproductive because the reason we don't have enough fires is the ones who want to sit around and, God, I hope it happens on my shift. I'm ready to go. The pager watchers, the radio listeners, they're just one heartbeat away, one breath away from jumping on the rig.
Certainly I understand that, Billy, but on the other hand, you know, when I do talks around the kitchen table of firehouses around here and wherever, I always ask that question about, especially to the young ones, what do you guys think about fire prevention programs? And they look at me like I'm crazy usually and say, well, we've got a person that does that. And I say, well, what about... Don't you think you should study more on fire prevention and learn ways that you can talk to people about preventing fires? No, we need more fires because if we don't have more fires, we'll get out of practice and we won't be able to fight fires properly. That's the kind of comment that I get back more often than you can imagine.
Yep. And... So with that being said, I want to bounce back over to Tony if I can. Tony, I want to kind of finish up a comment with you real quick, and then we're going to take a quick commercial break. So based on the conversations we've had so far of where we are, what's your thoughts on how do we go from here? What's the next step? Because, you know, I know we're hoping John Pignatero calls in from D.C., and I'll say this, and certainly up in the Northeast, I know you've got this, but, you know, those D.C. guys, I know some of them that they don't sit around saying wishing for the next fire to come in. They sit around saying, when will the next fire come in? Because they fight fire on a regular basis. They're proficient, kind of what Jason was saying earlier. He needed the pit bulls, those guys on his crew that are ready to go. But like in D.C., those guys are already there because they're doing it every single day, unfortunately. And when you live in a city like Washington, D.C., which was not a very, very big town, and have 21 fire deaths in 1 year, civilian fire deaths, that's not a good thing. So what's your thoughts so far, Tony?
Well, Bill, you came to a great point in the perspective of that, D.C., there's a lot of work, and they keep busy. And I would venture to say there's enough firefighters in those urban areas that go like, you know what, I've had 10, 15 years of this. Send me to training, send me to inspections, send me to a slower station because I'm tired of seeing the baby in the closet with its head burn off. I'm tired of being on the fire. And by the way, I was an incident commander on a line of duty death fire. So for anybody who thinks that's just as just an honor, it's not. It's an honor to recognize the line of duty death. And I'm on the local assistant state team, and I plan funerals in the state of New Jersey for line of duty death firefighters. So I understand what fire departments and families go through. I've had my own tragedy in my life with my first wife passing away years ago from breast cancer. And the point is that death, you know, while people do it and die in an honorable way, it's nothing to look forward to. I mean, we're all going to die, but it's definitely nothing that we want to see somebody's life shortened by, especially with a 2-year-old in a closet or a 36-year-old firefighter at home saving his fiance and his father. As Steve Austin said today, we got to provide the big picture to everybody. And I think that John said it wonderful. The people out there, and others said, the people out there don't want fires in their house. They don't want to see fire. They don't want to see death. They don't want to see injury. The perspective is that people got to understand we're hired to do a job, whether you're a career volunteer, and your job is to reduce the incidence of fire, however that may be. And, again, I'm a type A personality, as said earlier by Jason. I love the energy and getting involved in emergencies. But on the other hand, I know my ultimate job is, as John Marr said, to prevent them. And I just want to quickly go over prevention is that if you take the time as a firefighter to watch what happens when you engage with children or families in fire prevention and the amount of respect and honor they have for you and how they look up to you, you'll get almost as good a feeling as it is when you went in to fight a fire. You don't understand the impact unless you take the time to understand what it's like to engage with that child or even just a child and the parents are watching you. That's how you gain respect for your organization. And I was with one of your mentors, and obviously you have a lot of respect for him because you put him out training a lot. It's Chief Brunicini. I mean, customer service is all about treating people right. And one of the things is to stop that fire whenever possible. And the second thing is, intervening as early as possible. So I think we need to look at the big picture. Everybody needs to understand who we're doing, what we're doing, and who we're there for. And I was on a post earlier today on Facebook where people were worrying what happened to a fire company, and they lose perspective that we all work for somebody. Somebody owns our ability to go to a job. At any time, somebody could say, no, we don't want to do that. Let my house burn down or you know, we're not going to have a fire department. We're going to put all our money in prevention. So the fire service got to get to smart to the people that, again, whether volunteer, career, whether you take tax money, whether you take bingo money, however you come in, somebody's paying for you and allowing you to come to their house when 911 is dispatched.
All right.
So, you know, we got to start with the bigger picture and understand that perspective.
All right. Well, thanks, Tony, for that comment. We appreciate that. This we're going to take a quick break, go to a commercial, and everybody's going to take a breath and refresh, and we'll come right back. For those of you who are listening in, you can call in 855-345-4723. Again, that's a toll-free number, 855-345-4723. Again, this is Billy Hayes, and I'm your host for Stop, Drop, and Roll with the Punches. We'll be back in just a moment. Life is complicated, but your education shouldn't be. At Columbia Southern University, we'll make sure of it.
We offer quality online programs, low-cost tuition, textbooks at no cost, and caring faculty and staff to help ease the transition of going back to school. We'll be here to support you every step of the way, from application to graduation.
We also offer financial savings through our scholarship opportunities and learning partnership programs.
Your success is our success.
So join the CSU family, and together we can achieve your dreams.
Looking for timely information and insights to support today's fire service demands? FiregroundLeadership.com provides outstanding e-media offerings across a broad range of topics that include lessons from the fireground, building construction and fire dynamics, adaptive fireground management, tactical discipline, and much more. FiregroundLeadership.com, operational excellence on today's evolving fireground. A buildingsonfire.com series, now on Penwell's Fire EMS blog, a part of the fireengineering.com, Firefighter Nation, Fire Rescue Magazine, e-media services.
Hey, welcome back. This is your host, Billy D. Hayes. Stop, Drop, and Roll the Punches. Again, it's a special edition. We're touching on the subject of where are we in today's fire service, the thin line between aggressive and overzealous. So I'm going to go to our good friend Jason in the Atlanta area. Jason, you know what? This stuff doesn't appeal to me. You know what? I don't want to talk about less being warm and fuzzy and customer service. By gosh, I joined the fire service to fight fire. That's what I do, and that's what I want to do, and that's what I'm here for. That's what I get paid for. I don't want to talk about prevention. Put your Sparky the Dog costume on or go play with your robot and puppets and crawl through your fire safety house. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm waiting for the call to come in so I can burn my helmet off the top of my head. Now, with that being said, those are some of the things that I've experienced. Feedback and comments and darts thrown at me, and I'm willing to step out front. Somebody's got to lead. I'm willing to be the point man on the platoon to take the bullet first. To all these people, I mean, back to the comment and the when I went on to the Fire Rescue One post about the whole, this is the look I have when we catch a structure fire, I had people calling me volunteers, which then they were attacked by volunteers saying, hey, wait a second, probably fight more fire than you do as a career firefighter. Then I got called names I'm not going to repeat over the air. You know, I've probably never been in the fire service. I don't know what I'm talking about. Now, so Jason, I'm going to ask you a question because you want the pit bulls on your engine company as a company officer. How do you appeal to those guys? How do you keep the pit bulls corralled? Because we do need them. Don't get me wrong. We need those guys that are experienced. They're trained. They're ready to go. If my house is on fire, I want their butts on the rig to pull me out if it happens. But with less calls and to try to be more sociable and warm and fuzzy, what's the balance? How do you keep them? How do you keep them motivated, Jason?
Well, with my particular department, you know, as most are now, we're an all hazards service. You know, we run the EMS transports within the county. We do fire suppression, hazmat. We have a GSAR unit, which is Georgia Search and Rescue. Anyone's unfamiliar, just FEMA-type response within the state. We've got so many different things going on within the department that there are so many different avenues to take. There's not enough time in the day, really, to train for everything. My personal approach, and something that I was told, you know, long ago, a busy house is a happy house. It seems you have less morale problems, you have less attitudes, you have less of the personnel issues that some of the slower stations have. My approach has always been, you know, we've got all these hazards to mitigate now. You know, we've kind of adopted all these different issues. There's always something to train on. There's always something to look at, to research. There's also always something to debate. You know, our department's been really good in providing the resources to pursue these avenues and to debate over these topics. They're very open. I've used that approach as an officer. You know, I kind of dictate the pace of the day. Try to see that, you know, there's enough downtime that the guys, you know, have a chance to cool down, relax, you know, whatnot. But I fill that gap with training, I think. Training, you know, competitive training to a certain extent sometimes. You know, time limits or, hey, man, who can do this the fastest? Who can do that? You know, it's never going to replace that adrenaline rush or the you know, that wanting to get at what they're trained for, which is to fight fire. But it's a good stopgap for those measures, and it keeps it in line. And at the same time, I wanted to say this. All the points that have been made to this point, you know, up to now, they're excellent. They're outstanding. You know, and being 20 years in, I've seen that loss of property, loss of life, and it's heartbreaking. It truly is. And everyone's absolutely right. It takes one of those to really stop you and make you reflect on what am I doing. So I try to bring a little bit of that into them too. One example, I had them all sit down and listen to the 9/11 tapes, you know, at the station. I made them listen to all the dispatches, the Maydays, the calls out. And if you've never heard them, they're chilling. You know, so many of them are. And that was just one way for me to try to bring home the reality of what they're wanting to do, which is to jump on the rig and take off to that next one. At the same time, the training and whatnot, it keeps them fresh. It keeps them engaged in the profession. So that's kind of my corralling, as you'd say.
John, I know you want to jump in here.
You, John Marsh, right?
Yeah.
I don't disagree with the who was it, Tony on there?
Jason.
I don't disagree.
Jason.
Jason, I'm sorry. I don't disagree with the bulldog attitude. I can't put it into a scenario, but I think that if we could find ways in today's fire service prevention programs as exciting as fighting the fire. And like I say, I don't think you can do it exactly with a set program in the firehouse. One of the things I used to like to do, and it was when I was off duty, of course, and Billy, I told you about this years ago, I used to like to go into bars where I knew that contractors hung out. Now, if you're sitting around with a contractor and you're having a beer, one of the best things you can bring up is fire sprinkler systems. And you know what's going to happen? Half of them are going to argue with you over fire sprinkler systems. And they'll get to the point that they, if you ask them, what's wrong with them? They will say, well, they're too expensive. And they freeze. And you don't want your whole house soaked. Well, when they say that, that gives me my cue that these guys don't know what they're talking about. And it's through no fault of their own, because no one on their in their contracting actually installs sprinkler systems. So they don't know how they operate, and they don't know the purpose of them. And it gives me a chance when I'm sitting there and sipping a beer, and I say, oh, no, they don't work that way. It's only where the fire is. That sprinkler head will go off, and it will put out that one spot. Oh, are you serious? You mean they don't go off throughout the entire house? Exactly. And that's when you look at prevention, you know, sprinkler system, that's our savior at this day and age. And the stuff that we're witnessing being built, this wafer board and these I-beams that are made out of wafer board, it's just, I feel sorry for today's firefighters. These kids are, they're walking into ovens that they will be real lucky to walk out of. You know,
you're dead on with that, John. I mean, you're on to something there, because there's so much research and information out and out. You're talking about the new construction and what we're facing, and NIST and UL has done all these studies. And I ask firefighters, and I have the fortune of being able to travel around, and I talk to firefighters, and I said, have you seen the NIST studies? Have you seen the research studies? Tony, you mentioned Chief Brunicini earlier. You know, he has a philosophy: put as much water on you on the fire as you can, as fast as you can, from as far away as you can. And that's not something new. That's something Chief Brunicini has said for years. But yet we still immerse ourselves right in the middle of it, and we've tried to find our way to get out of it after sometimes it's just way too late. But when we specifically look at the events that we're facing, the fires that we do have, they're burning quicker. People say, oh, well, they're burning hotter. Well, they're burning quicker, John, and exactly. I think that's where you were going.
Yesterday, I'm going to give you another example of fire prevention programs that are on a real small level. 2 days ago, I was here at the condo in my house, and I walked outside, and there's a new subdivision going up right next door. I mean, they're slapping these houses up. They're going three at a time in a day, you know, and the things are completely framed, and they've got the shingles on. And there's two old ladies who live next door, and they're looking at the houses with me, and I said, gee, that is complete junk that's going to burn like matches. And they said, what do you mean it's going to burn like matches? I said, well, if it ever catches fire, look what this stuff is made of. That's all glued together pieces of wood. It's full of flammable items, the glue and the polymers that they're using in that stuff. It's going to burn like crazy. There's no sprinklers in those houses. Well, you know, I never thought about it. What about this place where we live? Is it safe from fire? And, of course, I knew what the construction is of the building I live in, and explained, oh, yes, it's much safer than what they're building there. In other words, at least we'll have a jump on this. If it catches fire, we'll have firefighters be able to extinguish it if they get here within 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
So, John, I want to pause you for just a second, because I want to ask Jason a question. Jason, with new firefighters that are assigned to your companies, how many of them have a thorough knowledge of building construction?
Good question. Coming straight out of rookie school, they have a very rudimentary knowledge of it.
Right.
You know, the MPQ, you know, you can't cover everything everywhere. I try to supplement it as much as possible. When we're doing fire safety surveys and whatnot, I try to point out, you know, here's the rafters, you know, here's, you know, truss construction and whatnot. But, that's definitely a weakness in the service right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's part that, you know, I think a lot of them don't see, oh, that's part of the job. You know, it's one of those drier subjects, one of the tougher ones to get them to lock onto and engage in. So definitely a weakness.
So that goes back to something that John said earlier, something I've been saying for quite a while, and it's certainly part of my fire porn article, is how do you make it sexy? Because that's what we've painted this job as, and that's great. It's been done for years and years, and I don't think it was that much. My dad was an Atlanta firefighter, and I don't think he ever joined the fire service because it was a sexy profession, because it was a good career, it had good benefits, it was a steady income, and there was the ability to make supplemental income on your days off. It wasn't so much seen as what Hollywood has turned us into, and certainly with social media and T-shirts and everything and tattoos that we've turned into, it's a different group that we're facing. And, you know, we're kind of at a crossroads, because you have those folks that are coming in that, you know, want to be aggressive firefighters, and God bless them. And again, I'd love to have them on my crew with the right training of there's a time to be aggressive and there's time to be conscious of what we're facing. But then also, Jason, you've probably seen it, and Tony, I know you saw it in your time as well as John, that there's a smarter group coming in as well. And these folks joining the department now, they're coming in with college degrees. They understand the ability to do research and have a better understanding of things that are going on around them, and they don't want to put as much at stake. And then you hear that on the other side is, well, the kids who are joining the job now, they don't want to fight fire. They just want to come in for the paycheck and the insurance, as that other knucklehead said about me. They just want to be different. And so we've got a diverse group that we're trying to please to keep them motivated, to keep them focused, to keep them trained. So it's kind of a cash. Jason, are you seeing that?
Oh, very much so. You're exactly right. I mean, I've got a couple at my station that, you know, I have to try to keep up with them, typing a report, anything like that. You know, it's, they're tech savvy, they're media savvy. You're exactly right. And yeah, it's a challenge because we're hitting this strange period. You know, we had a mass exodus of the old vets go out. I think I had to explain to me when they started that third shift in the 70s, late 70s and whatnot, you know, especially around the metro area, that group of guys are gone. Now we've got a median group who's kind of me. You know, I started in 95. Right. And then we've got these new guys that are coming in. And you're right. You've got this diverse set of people, and it seems like no matter what you do, one will latch on to something, one will find the interest, one won't. You know, one group won't. So it's a station officer problem. This entire thing to me is definitely a station level officer issue. It's all in how you portray fire prevention. It's how you stress it. It's, you know, the tactics, the strategies, the, you know, getting them to buy into the product, realistically buy into the product, and having them understand it's not all about that fire. You know, and like I said, I go back. I try really hard to spread it out over everything we could encounter, to include prevention, you know, sprinkler systems and hooking to the standpipe and, you know, stuff like that. It's definitely a challenge. It's a challenge. I think the only way we're going to make any real good headway, I mean, you know, your administration can push down a lot of things. They can set policies and whatnot, but it's going to be those station officers that follow through with them and their attitude as they do it that's going to influence these guys, because they're watching you. Whether you know it or not, they're watching you. They're watching how you react. They're looking at your expression. They're looking at your body language. So,
With that said, Jason, can I jump in here? How does your administration react to such things as, if you would mention, you want to go out and do a fire inspection on a home, or someone calls you and wants you to come by and do an inspection, or you suggest that the company do some inspections in their downtime? How does your administration, do they empower you to do that, or do they frown on that?
Now, our current fire chief, he has a background in fire prevention also. Billy knows him pretty well. He's very pro prevention. I'm very fortunate where I'm at, and that we're empowered in many ways to be able to do something like that. So no, we don't run into any barriers on the admin level at all.
And speaking of that, when exactly what Jason was saying, I mean, I know his fire chief who came through prevention and is very proactive in that area, and he and I were talking the other day. And one of the things that fire chiefs need to be better at articulating downward, and communication's obviously two-way, but articulating downward is they have bosses as well. Just like firefighters answer to company officers answer to battalions, all the way up, so does the fire chief. And whether it be a city council like I responded to, or a county commissioner, fire board, or whatever it may be, we have bosses, and we have to be able to stand before them and say, okay, why, when we're asked, well, why weren't you there fast enough? well, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why are we having so many fires? What are we doing about this? Mrs. Smith, as Chief Brunicini likes to say, called me and complained because we weren't there quick enough or you didn't get water on it fast enough. And so all these things that fire chiefs are having to respond to, and that's part of their job. Everybody's got duties and responsibilities. But the ultimate goal is whatever's done at the company level, the fire chief has to answer for ultimately. So I can answer that for John, for Jason, myself, is when, you know, somebody calls Mrs. Smith, say, hey, can you come by? Absolutely. We'd love to come by because that gives you the ability to look and survey at as a residential structure that you may never get a chance to look at in case it's on fire in the middle of the night. Tony, you're ready to jump in on one. I know you've been sitting there and hit me up, so go ahead.
Yeah, I'm ready to spark it up. First of all, I want to say to Jason is that your position, that the company officer is the most important leadership position in the fire department. And after 38 years, I can say that with confidence. And we need to give you guys the tools and the ability to do your job and support you wherever. And if you're not a good company officer, then we need to put you somewhere else where you're not going to harm. But you're going to make the difference. So I applaud all company officers for the work they do. We said we were going to make this a little bit of spirit and really haven't got there. I'm going to push some stuff out here. You know, the fight what you fear group, I fight what you fear group, you know, and the Johnson Hose and all the T-shirt people because, as you know, I wrote about that last year. I suspect the majority of them really have never seen anything horrendous. They really haven't been in any bad times, and they really haven't had anything bad. If it was one of their family members that got hurt or killed, I suspect that they would be the first one passing out smoke detectors. I suspect they would be the first ones to go out and do home fire safety inspections. If they were the one that went in that fire and got burnt themselves, I suspect they would be the first ones to go, whoa, you know what? I would be more careful of the way I go. Again, as you said, we need good, aggressive firefighters, but they need to be smart, as Jason said. They need to be smart, intelligent firefighters, well-trained firefighters. And I'm going to put my plug in for crew resource management, that process allows you to make sure that when you have good, smart firefighters and good officers, that you have a good teamwork process to utilize to make sure you're doing the right job the right way and to be the most effective. As I said yesterday, you know, we all sit there and go, well, we made a good stop. How do you know you made a good stop? Please tell me, how do you know? What measurement, what performance measurement did you have? So there's a lot of talk. And also, for some reason, there's nostalgia. You want to be like us guys, you know, 38, 48, 50 years ago. Well, I started with fireball gloves, a tin senator helmet that I know that Dennis Rubin would just like to have. A three-quarter duck coat, rubber boots, and a demand-only SCBA. So I can only, I can only go so far into the fire. Today, you've got this protective envelope. You could probably walk up into the fire and roast marshmallows, have hot dogs, and not even feel it. So the kids today, and I'm not picking, but I think the kids today are great. We just need to be able to provide them the direction, as my buddy Tiger would say. I think I believe you left in the hospital or something. I'm not sure about that, but we'll get back to that later. But anyway, you know, we got to take these kids and we got to give them some perspective of what really is going on. And I don't have a problem having some nostalgia, but what we lived in wasn't, I mean, we had some hard fighting firefighters, but they were only to be able to go so far, you know. The gear stopped us. Today, the gear doesn't stop us. And then the last thing I want to say, and I really want to push it, in the military, in the fire service, the EMS service, why we got so many suicides. What is going on? What are they seeing that's so bad that kids, and it's not adults, kids are killing themselves? Why? Why is this happening? So we need to look at this in a bigger perspective as opposed to, well, I just want to get near a fire. Yes, sir, I want to fight fire. I want to do a technical rescue. I want to have a good extrication save, but I don't wish that on anybody. I hope it never happens again, but if it comes, yes, I want to be the person there. But if I'm not, that's okay. And if I prevented it, if I prevented a fire, I prevented a death, I prevented an education and an extrication, then I even feel better about myself. So let's think about some of the real-world stuff that's going on before we start talking about that we're being too thin-skinned, because I'm not thin-skinned. After 38 years, brother, I'll go wherever you go. But on the other hand, I don't want Mrs. Smith to have to go there.
You know, when you talk about brotherhood, Tony, there's certainly nothing like having to take our good friend Tiger Schmittendorf to Gettysburg Hospital after he sat outside in the back of an ambulance for 30 minutes outside of Otthouse Bar, you know. So, and I hope he's listening because, yeah, John Mitchell even sent me a message. That story never dies, nor will we ever let it die, will we? So I do want to add to this, though, is you know, back to the chief level. You know, when we have to answer to our board of commissioners and or city council, or mainly to the public, and this goes to every firefighter, you know, we got to paint a bigger picture, and that's something that executives in the fire service do not do very well. And meaning that when you do have a structure fire, and those guys who are praying for the big fire to come in, okay, well, let's say we have one of our main industries in our town is a lumber yard or whatever it may be, or we only have one grocery store in our town for volunteer departments, who I know don't see anywhere nothing like this. But, you know, just think about this. When that building burns, dollars are being lost. Those dollars are being lost on tax revenue. I mean, the tax sales receipts. That company may not relocate if the building's a total loss. They may not come back and rebuild there at that location. The building's gone. You know what? We're going to move somewhere else. This is our chance. So there's money gone from the city when there's or town or whatever. When we lose a single-family dwelling, a structure fire, and I can remember where I was the fire chief in the city of Riverdale, when we had houses that would burn there, and they would stay boarded up for months and months into years, and that's a blight on the community. And who wants to live next door to a boarded up, burned out house? Because then people thinking, well, this is a low income or a horrible area, people start moving out. And then all of a sudden you have a demise in your community. Again, that affects the taxes. It affects the money coming in. It affects how much money is allocated to budgets for fire departments. So we got to look at a bigger picture, that not only is fire harmful to people and their well-being as far as physical, but also economic issues in our communities as well. And we don't even talk about that in the recruit school. That's not even mentioned because that's so far above us. By gosh, put the patch on my shirt. I'm ready to go.
Exactly right, Billy. And we're to the point, too, that we I won't go there. I was going to get into politicians, but I guess I better not. You're running low on time here. But there's got to be an understanding between chiefs and administrators, town councilmen and whatever their trustees or whatever their titles are. We got to begin in little steps. That's one of the biggest steps that they have to take as the chief of a department. You know, even in the interview, when they go in to apply for a chief job, I think they have to, they can't be yes men anymore, yes women. They can't just go in and say, yes, I'll take care of that. I'll see that that's done. They have to be able to express the needs of what we have to do in the service, the fire service, to prevent these deaths of firefighters and civilians alike.
Don, it's Tony, and I agree with you 100%, but being in that position, when you're an at-will employee, you better balance that decision to tell them the way it really is and be fired tomorrow, and then how well can you help your firefighters when you're gone. So, and Billy, I'm sure you can tell them it's a it's a delicate balancing act to be able to support your firefighters in the fire department, and on the other end, be able to do the job that's expected by the elected officials that put you in that position.
Yep, great point, Tony. Jason, I know you had something you wanted to say about the economics effects.
Yeah, that just brought up a great point. We're actually going through that sort of problem right now in the department, you know, the community I work in. You're absolutely right. I think that there needs to be a lot more emphasis in rookie school about, you know, just what you did, starting from ground up, fire, all the way up to the economic effects of it, the blight on the community. You know, it's absolutely true. I mean, it's where I'm at right now is just, it's a gold mine as far as location, location, location. As you know, Billy, I mean, we've got major interstates, we've got the airport, we've got all sorts of things going on for that area. But when people move out, the millage rate drops. You know, I mean, it stays the same, but you have less of a population that you're collecting from. You know, the prevention part, I mean, I know I'm taking the part of the bulldogs and the get in there and fight thing, but I can't help but agree with some of what you guys are saying. The fire prevention part is such an important part of this whole story. It's a much larger picture than that one dimension. It's absolutely essential.
Jason, to come to what you're saying, though, and talking about the pit bulls, you know, we need to educate the firefighters in recruit school the importance of well-placed stations, good communications, dispatch communications, and how that system rolls, good water supply, good training, because all that affects our ISO. But having a crew that is well-trained and being able to put those apparatus on scene in a faster response can stop some of the destruction. So instead of having a house that's a complete loss or a business that's a complete loss, we also have the ability to put well-trained firefighters with enough resources to stop it so it's not a complete loss, to give either that family or that entrepreneur an opportunity to rebuild so we don't lose them out of the community. So, you know, again, it's that fine line. We're one step in any direction of how do we balance this, because, you know, I'm not advocating whatsoever that we just say, oh, everything, we stand from the outside and hit it from the outside, even though you can put a lot of fire out from the outside. It's about your risk-benefit analysis. But understanding that we don't want to risk our firefighters, we don't want to sit around and hope for that fire to come in, because it's a bigger response, it's a bigger effect. It has more results than just our self-gratification of being able to fight a fire. So, you know, maybe from this you take back to your company and start sharing it with your folks, and Tony and John, I know you're there as well. I mean, share it with people that, you know, a fire is more than just the risk to the people who live there. It's a greater risk to the firefighters who respond, but it also has a repercussion on the community in which you live in, an economic effect.
You know, Billy, that's a good point you bring up. One of the ways you could make it exciting for your fire company, your crew, is to discuss things such as how much does it cost you to make a response? You know, what a great discussion that would be for around the kitchen table someday, a good training. How much does it cost the city or the county, whatever the case may be, if we go out on any kind of a fire that you're wishing for, how much would that cost us? How much would it cost the city? Figure that out. Break that down into numbers. And I think you'll see these kids, I'm sorry I would keep referring to kids. I'm so old, like, everyone's a kid to me. But they'll look at you like, you mean it costs money? that's the response you get a lot. So that's a good drill, though, as far as a beginning of simple economics in the fire service, and then you, Jason, you can explain to the the crew, well, you see what I'm against when you guys make these calls. I have to stay within a reasonable budget, so to speak. And
right.
We can't just sit around and wish to have runs for the heck of it. You know?
Yep. So, Tony, you said you had some questions you wanted to spout out.
Questions or comments, and it's really a wrap on all of this. You know, again, we don't act in a vacuum, and we need to provide our recruits all of the information that we discussed, and for some reason the budgets don't make it. We don't have time, but we're being disingenuous, and we're not doing anybody a favor. And as especially Jason said, we're getting a lot of young, smart firefighters in there to ask why questions. We can't answer their why questions if we don't give them the information. I know Bernardillo County did a great job years ago with firehouse etiquette, how to act, what to expect. The only thing missing was giving them a little bit of the overview of the organization they work for and a political overview. I spent some time, like I said, talking to a retired Marine colonel, and if we spent a little bit more time being like the Marines and giving them some history in it and why we do what we do and honor what other people did by being better than the last generation and being a little bit better and having knowledge of why we do what we do, instead of saying, you know, and like I said, I hope I incent a couple people to ask questions and make comments. But, you know, I'm just here to fight fire. That's my only job. And if you think your job is to save lives, then why don't you put more interest in prevention? Why don't you put more interest in EMS? I guarantee you that probably just got quite a few people upset. But just think how many people we can save and doing better at myocardial infarction response or stroke response at 3 o'clock in the morning, right, guys, or, you know, taking 5 minutes to get out the door. So, there's a lot of ability for us to be better, but we have to show them all what the big picture is and how we're making an impact. And we have to continue to provide them feedback on a regular basis of what the organization is doing in the community later.
Yep. And we, I think you're on to something there, Tony. We don't market internally. And not only does the fire service not market out to the community, we don't market what we need to say internally. I mean, we give them the T-shirts and we give them the gear and we give them expectations. And, you know, I love all these conferences I go to, and I cannot wait to get to Indianapolis in a couple of weeks for FDSE. I've been off the road for 2 months, and I'm dying to get back out on the road and hang out with my brother and sister firefighters again. But it's a calling that we have to get to because, man, there's going to be a lot of toys there, like new fire trucks and new nozzles, new gear, new SCBAs and all that. And there's going to be a lot of great classes there. And I'm fortunate to be able to present there. And last year I presented FDSE, and I had about 40 people in a fire prevention class. And I did the class I typically do, the fire prevention paradox, is our culture killing us. There was over 40 people in that class, and I'm thinking, how in the world – at FDIC, do I get 40 people in a fire prevention class? And the comments on the evaluations is, we need more of this. We need more of this. And I think because we haven't marketed to our folks appropriately and sold them the message of what the principles and values of our of what we do are. And, you know, like this guy who said, we're called firefighters, not fire preventers. Wow, you've been in the fire service 10 years. You're a career firefighter. Woo, I'm impressed. You obviously didn't get the message. And
right.
And he's probably been to two fires his entire career, and one was a dumpster and one was a garbage can.
I'm not arguing with you there, that's for sure.
So, you know, but then again, there's those guys who like in D.C. and Chicago and other departments, and now I'm not just saying the big departments, that do fight a lot of fire and very proficient at it. And I can tell you, I would guess, John, you know the Cincinnati area just as much as I do, and you mentioned Coleraine Township. My good friend Captain Joe Hempel, who's probably listening in tonight, you know, you guys probably understood that FAO Daryl Gordon probably wasn't sitting around hoping to have a fire on that high-rise fire they went to. What do you think?
I had that discussion with someone down here yesterday. I mean, talking about, you know, he was an FAO. And amongst ourselves, we said, well, why was he doing interior? You know? And, of course, the investigation will bring out the results of all that. But and why did he go down an elevator shaft? You know, he's got 30 years experience. What went wrong? And it's so sad at that point in your career when you're retiring and you're probably placed on someone was sick on that shift and you had to fill in for that person that was sick. You know, you were a firefighter short. But he did it. You know, he got in there and he did whatever he had to do. And that was, and speaking of Polaring Township, I think tomorrow, when's the 4th? Tomorrow is day after tomorrow, I guess.
Day after tomorrow.
Is the anniversary of the two, Robin Roxterman.
Robin Troxel.
Roxterman. And
yep.
What was her last name? And the other fella. That was, what I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago now.
You know, when you ask the question, is why was he there? Why was Daryl at that fire? And it's because something went wrong on the front end. And I'll tell you how, and I kind of want to wrap the show up with this, and I'll give you all a chance to have some closing thoughts here as we end up the show. But when I spoke to a friend of mine about the Fresno incident, and he texted me at midnight after the event occurred earlier in that day, and we had been texting back and forth and, you know, checking on him and all that. And I said, Chief, how did the fire start? And he said, Billy, you're the first person to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, we got to get in that frame of mind, whether it's Jason, Tony, or John Yu, we all have to be in that frame of mind to look at it and say, how could this event have been prevented? And I've dealt with it. I dealt with it in Riverdale. You know, Tony, you talk about until you had a baby's head burn off or something like that. I remember June 7th in 2007 at the Budget Inn in the city of Riverdale where I had to go up. I almost lost two firefighters trying to rescue a family of six out of a hotel room that was on the call, on the phone with 911, screaming for us to come get them. And because the building, the rooms were misnumbered and we couldn't get to them, and as the crews tried to get up there, the roof collapsed and cut the firefighters off. And having to go in, and there's five dead bodies all piled up in a bathroom with two kids in the bathtub, whether they drowned or burnt, they had no burn injuries, probably suffocated, and the kids probably drowned. And then a 14-year-old girl who we thought was going to put in a body bag, who was the sixth victim, her arm twitched. And Jason, I don't know if you remember that particular call or not, but her arm twitched as we was getting ready to bag her, and she was still alive and wound up surviving that incident. Until people have been through that and asked the question, how did we even get here? How did we get here? Okay, so yeah, we're happy to guns and hoses type T-shirts of respond to that call. But how did we get here to begin with? Why did this event occur? And to me, that's the change I want to lead in the fire service, is we start looking and saying, how can we prevent these? Not wishing they occur, but how can we prevent them from occurring? We know inherently there's a risk to our job. We know inherently that there is going to be an event occur, because natural disasters and mechanical disasters, whatever it may be. How do we get there?
On the bright side, too, of that, if there is such a thing as a bright side of that tragic fire in Cincinnati, before Daryl died, he and his crew saved 13 people, or rescued 13 people from that fire.
Right.
And that was started by food on the stove. It was a cooking fire.
And from what I understand, in Fresno, the garage was actually a living area. It was a home for individuals with disability, and they turned the garage into a living area. So it wasn't truly storage for a garage. It was a living area. So, and police had responded to that incident or to that structure two previous times during the day.
Yeah,
for the one out in Fresno.
What could prevention have done for both of those fires? Right? A fire prevention program.
Right. Yep. So, I mean, that's, again, the events happened. Somebody has to respond to them, and we want the best trained firefighters and who are willing to take a risk to save somebody. But what the whole point of the show tonight was, you know, there's a thin line between those who are battle prepared versus those who are mentally wishing for it to happen. So I'm going to throw it over to Jason. I'll ask you first to close out, then I'll go to John Marsh, and then Tony will close out the show. Jason, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, Billy, first, I appreciate you guys. It's been an honor, man. I've not done very many of these. I hope I get the opportunity to do it again sometime with you. My side of things, I'm still leaning towards those pit bulls, but my ideal role model or model of a firefighter would be the quiet professional, the guy who has what he needs. He's got that skill. He's got the skill set to a mastery level. He's got the knowledge. That knowledge includes building construction, fire prevention, how to talk to people, EMS, hazmat, you know, the full spectrum of things. And I think as you progress in your career, if you have the right officers, you have the right leadership who can bring that bit of brevity or levity to your career without breaking your spirit. That's that thin line. Without breaking that spirit of that pit bull, that guy that really wants it all. It's the name of the game. Like I said, I think that on a station officer level, it's got to be addressed. And you've got to get these lieutenants, captains, the station officers to buy into that prevention program, to buy into it, figure out new and exciting ways to present it to these younger guys. It needs to be emphasized more from the start, from rookie school. They need to understand the tragedy, the loss that we're going to experience in a career. You know, it's a long career. You've got to be prepared for it. So you guys are taking a lot of the fight out of me, really. I was already on the line when it came to what we were looking for here in the argument itself. I was hoping I could bring a little bit of both sides to the game here, and I hope I did a little bit, but I truly enjoyed it. You guys have already taught me a lot, man. I appreciate
Jason,
it.
Jason, you did great. You did exactly what we know. Unfortunately, John Pignatero wasn't able to join us tonight because he would have been on that side with you, and the outcome may have been a little bit different. But, you know, please don't get us wrong. We're not discouraging what you've got, and Tony said this earlier. You have the most important job in the fire service. As a company officer, you have more influence, and company officers throughout the organization have more influence than the fire chief ever could. And I'm probably sure your fire chief may be listening tonight. I hope he is. And I can tell you from my role when I sat as a fire chief, I could write policies and I could try to give vision, but nothing worked. No morale booster would work more than the company officer taking charge. And you have that ability, Jason. You have the ability as a lieutenant to keep those pit bulls ready to go, ready to run, but also keep them at bay to where it doesn't get them in danger. And, you know, behind the scenes, they're probably always going to wish that we had a fire. There's times I wish I was back on the fire truck. Every day I wish I was back on the fire truck. Not that I want to see somebody's possessions burn, but exactly what you said in the post, when it does, and when that emergency occurs, buddy, I want to be there. I want to be the one that can mitigate that situation and take it on. And there is nothing wrong with that. Every single firefighter in this country should be that mentally prepared, that battle prepared. But just these guys who sit around, and social media I think has made it worse for everything, is to sit around and say, God, that's what we get paid to do. All these pansy want to be preventers, and that's not what we get paid for. You as a company officer have the ability to guide the direction of that company. And buddy, I think you're doing a good job with it.
Thank you, Billy. Thank you.
John, any closing thoughts for you, sir?
Simply, it's maybe when you guys are out on the fires, when you're going to these residential structures or whatever the scenario may wind up being when you get there, if there's no fire whatsoever, at least take the time, look around the place, if it's in your district, see if you see anything that could prevent a fire, that it's a possible fire in the future. Maybe not even have to say anything to the resident owner, but take it back to the fire station with you and discuss it when you sit around and talk about this and that at the kitchen table each night. If you need some programs to follow as far as fire prevention programs that can be interesting now in this day and age, follow people like the Louisville Fire Department in Kentucky. They've got a great prevention program up there. Billy, your organization in the state of Alabama has a great prevention campaign going on, or they did the last I heard. Look into those programs, fellows, and at least make an attempt to learn about fire prevention.
And yeah, here in the state of Alabama, the numbers have gone through the roof. Last year in 2014, they were higher than they ever been with civilian fatalities, and they started a program called Turn Your Attention to Fire Prevention through the Alabama Association of Fire Chiefs, and really trying to take this on and take ownership of it. And the chiefs have gathered up and said, you know, enough's enough. We got to do something about this. And John, you hit on something, and I want to build off of that for the listeners who may be listening and anybody else, is not only when you're out on a call, take a look around, but even when you go on a medical call. If you go on a medical call, you should ask those people if they have working smoke alarms in their house, and if they don't, you need to go get one off the rig and put it up. You know, I had somebody say something, or I saw one of the posts talk about liability. You know, what happens if you do install a smoke alarm and they have a fire and still somebody dies? How is the fire department liable? Well, my God, it's no different than if you go there and on a medical call and you don't. To me, you're not fulfilling your job as a public servant, especially of a firefighter, and making sure that they do have a working smoke alarm before your rig leaves that house. So.
Well, you're not doing as much as you could be doing.
That's exactly right. So, Tony, I want to close out with you, my friend. Thanks for hanging in there with us and all your trying to spark it up a little bit. So, I'll as much as you're involved with the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, buddy, you roll with it.
First of all, finally, it's 4 years since I got on the radio with you. But it's great that it's a good topic. I'm going to go start and try to stay at the 50,000-foot level because it's the important thing that we've talked about, but it's the elephant in the room. There's people that hire and pay for you that you don't – a lot of people don't respect them. It's like, well, we're the fire department. We know what's best for you. You're wrong. There's constituents, voters, customers, and people say we don't have customers. They're residents or they're taxpayers. No, they're customers, because at any time they can vote to change who they pay for. And we've seen it in the recent recession when they closed firehouses. I saw it where I was in Missouri, and they said, you know what? We said people are going to die. They don't care. People don't want to hear people are going to die, babies are going to die. It's all about dollars and cents. It's all about bucks. So if you don't understand the big perspective at the 50,000-foot level of who's taking care of you, who's paying you, and what their expectations are, you're going to fail miserably, no matter how well-trained, how proficient you are, how much equipment you have. The second point is technology's changing so quick. We put on man on the moon in 1968, and we can't get sprinklers in everybody's house. We can't get smoke detectors in everybody's house. We have cell phones that we can do almost every incredible thing, but we can't monitor fire or prevent fire with technology. And I bring it because people are watching it. And when we continue to act in archaic ways of managing fire, somebody else is going to take our job. Whether it's the Home Fire Safety Council, and as you know, Mary Lee K. Appy has done an awesome job with that organization. Somebody else will come in and take our prevention. Red Cross is giving away smoke detectors now. How many firefighters know the Red Cross is giving away smoke detectors? These are all at the big picture level. I'm going to talk about the military quickly. And I'm an old hippie from the way back in Vietnam War. Didn't believe them, but the military does great things. They don't fight today's war like they did in World War II, World War Korean War, Vietnam, even the first Iraqi war. They're better each time they go at it. They're looking for ways to be more effective and efficient, having less fighting, to fight less, to lose less soldiers, to lose less equipment. So we need to look at the big picture, the people who are out there and what their expectations are before we get comfortable in our own little world, because somebody will shake it up on us. And believe me, I'm sure there's a lot of firefighters out there that's already been shaken up on. So, you know, even if you're not in the EFO program, get into a program where you learn research. Take college. If you don't end up with a bachelor's degree at the end of your career, then you're not doing yourself a service, and not just a service, but when you get into the educational process, what you learn, do research, applied research, look at research, read research, because the world's changing really quickly, and if we don't keep up with it, it's going to pass us by, and our cheese is going to be moved 3,000 miles away, and we're going to be standing in the same point grumbling without
a job. Good point, Tony. Thanks for bringing that up. In fact, my last show was on education experience. What are we looking for in the fire chief? And I had Rich Marinucci and Dr. Scott Rounds on, and we spoke of that. And the main thing about education, the importance of it in the fire service these days, is the ability to do the research, because it's a different industry we're living in. It's not just one IFSTA manual that we have to learn. There's so much going on in our business, and it's truly turned into a true profession and not just a blue-collar workforce. So I appreciate it. Listen, guys, I appreciate everything that you said tonight. I appreciate your time hanging out with us and spending an hour and a half talking about this important subject. I know we've got so much more to talk about. I'm sure there'll be a part two, and I'd love to have you guys back. We'll try to stir it up a little bit more. John Mitchell will have this edited, and we'll put it out on Facebook tomorrow on my pages, and certainly we want you to share it. So, John Mitchell, I'm going to turn it over to you guys. Thanks. Again, this is your host, Billy D. Hayes, hosting Stop, Drop, and Roll with the Punches. John Mitchell, take us home, my friend.